consider becoming members of the Institute if you aren't already. I'd like, first of all, to thank UBC Bookstore again for being the sponsor of our series. Their commitment and support is very much appreciated. Tonight, to celebrate Einstein's 117th birthday, we are very pleased to welcome Nobel laureate Professor Martin Pearl of Stanford University. Professor Pearl was born in Brooklyn and studied chemical engineering. After graduating, right after World War II, he went to work for General Electric as a chemical engineer. There, a wise mentor suggested that Pearl really should study science. Following this advice, he enrolled in the Physics Graduate School of Columbia University, at that time one of the intellectual hotbeds of the new quantum physics. His PhD supervisor was the famous savant, government advisor, and Nobel laureate, Isidore Rabi. Pearl was then appropriately launched into a research career, much of which has been spent at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Laboratory. Professor Pearl has had an outstanding career, culminating in his Nobel Prize work for the discovery of the Theon, the first found member of the third generation of the basic building blocks of nature. Professor Pearl's discovery using SLAC's beam of particles has given us clues about why our universe contains more matter than antimatter, and this discovery has had profound implications for cosmology. Of course, Dr. Pearl did not know in advance that nature had three generations. He was just looking in a clearly intelligent way, and nature was benevolent for his search. Professor Pearl lives in Palo Alto in San Francisco and remains full of new ideas for experiments. His talk tonight is entitled, What Einstein Couldn't Have Known, Very Small Particles at Very High Densities. Please welcome Professor Martin Pearl.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. It's a great pleasure to be here. I want to thank Professor Vogt for inviting me. What Einstein couldn't know, there has two significances for me. One is the field that I work in, which is elementary particles, which I'll tell you something about, these very small bits of matter, was begun in the later part of his lifetime, but our real understanding of it came after he died. And so he couldn't have known it. But the second theme has to do with, in the end, science depends upon experiment and observation. Experiment and observation is the bedrock of science. And until certain things had been discovered or observed, Einstein couldn't have known them, no matter how brilliant he was, and he was indeed enormously brilliant. But what I want to emphasize and talk about is what I call the practice of experimental science. How do you actually do experiments? Because there are more myths about it, and the books don't tell you too much about it. It's really both an art and a craft. And that's what I want to tell you about tonight, using, for example, the work that I've been doing, and at the same time, introducing somewhat what my field is. Now, as Mr. Lemon told you, I was an engineer. So my view, the way I do work, always comes out of engineering. I'm very close into engineering, and that's part of my personality. So one of the myths of science is that there is a scientific personality. There is not a scientific personality. Different people do things different ways. Some people are very mathematical, Some people have extremely good memories. I tend to work the way an engineer might who then went into basic research. And the things I'll tell you then, you always have to take understanding somewhat where I come from. So my view of the world, having been an engineer, is very mechanical. The particles I see are little mechanical particles. And so the particle I found, which is the tau, I actually think of as a small particle. Now it's very small, it's much smaller than this, and in fact it may have no size. But I think of it as a particle, and my experiments are based on that sort of work. If things come up which can't be looked at from that point of view, which say have to do more with the philosophy of quantum mechanics or are very mathematical, then I stay away from it because that's not what I can do. And so particularly for the young people, you have to sort of find your own personality in doing science, especially experimental science. And that comes rather young. Now one of my introductions, because I'm from the United States, was of course Erector Sets. They assured me that wouldn't happen, but I'll hold on to these. If I'd grown up somewhere in the reaches of the British Empire, I would have, of course, worked on Meccano's. And I don't know, for those of you who have been close to those old toys, which are still made, Meccano's are still made, not in Britain, however, made actually in France. The Meccano was always considered a better kind of set, had more parts, better gears, things of this sort. Now, but the essence of any of those construction toys was this sort of thing, that with a few elements, you could construct all sorts of things. And if you were fortunate enough and your parents could afford it or were generous enough, then of course you get a big set and you could build something big. And this was always one of the things that children like to build, the so-called walking beam engine. So my approach comes two ways then. One, I like to think about things which are simple and made of a few elements. And hence, I ended up going from chemical engineering into physics. Secondly, I like the apparatus itself. So I only really like to do experiments if the equipment itself is of interest to me. Now, another aspect of my growing up in the 30s was really an era of tremendous interest in science, and this is from a Popular Science, a cover of the 30s. Always liked to have funny kinds of airplanes, and this is sort of a helicopter in which the wing is actually inflatable, and if you have trouble, I think you drop the motor and you can float down. Of course, that doesn't work, but it gives you this feeling of excitement and opening up and the mixing up of science and engineering. The other thing which comes out of the 30s all over the world, but particularly on the American continent, it was a time of great engineering feats. On the West Coast, there was the Golden Gate Bridge and the Hoover Dam. These, of course, things that I knew as a child in the United States. There were plastics came through. There was the dirigibles, the Pan American Clipper. All these things were amazing engineering feats. So this is then my background and is my personality in going into science. Now, that's one end of it. But now I have to say a few things about where I work in this scientific world. So let's start. Let's start at the top of this. I actually started out at the top myself because I was a chemical engineer. At the top are the large molecules, and the molecules are what give us most of our daily life. The chemistry, how metals work, how paints work, the biology, the medicine, all those are based on molecules. And that, of course, is where I started out also. Now, molecules are pretty small, and I've given these things sort of in fractions of an inch. But all the molecules are, of course, made up of atoms. And the atoms, in turn, consist of a nucleus with electrons going around it. Now, at this point, you have to begin to think a little bit about that you're visualizing things, but you don't really know their size. This, say, is a nucleus, and the simplest atom is, of course, hydrogen, which has one electron, and the electron is going around it. The electron is much smaller than the proton. In fact, it may have no size at all. And this is one of the great mysteries of our present-day physics, which may be answered, not by my generation, because we're completely stuck with it, but maybe by some of the young people in the room. How can an object like an electron, which has no size, well, we can't find the size, yet it has weight, that is, it has mass, it has electric charge, and it has some other properties, which I'll get to. It knows it's an electron. It's not something else. It knows what it is in some way, and yet it may have no size. So that we just live with. Okay. So here you have the atom, which is, and the electron is going around the proton. And now one is moving into atomic physics, and now you go further down and begin to look at what's inside the nucleus. Inside the nucleus are neutrons and protons, and they're a little bit harder to visualize, but they do have size. So sort of a nucleus is sort of a combined thing, maybe. If these little blue things are protons and these are neutrons, it sort of looks like this. It's quite tight. They're quite tight together, and they fill up the nucleus. Now, then we have still progressed further and gone into what's inside the proton and what's inside the neutron. And much of that work, which has to do is you're now mixed in between nuclear physics and what we call my field, elementary particle physics, has been done at the laboratory, which is in Vancouver, at Triumph. That's one of the major places where this sort of research is now done. Now, you could follow two lines. One could follow the left, your left line, inside a nucleus, inside the proton, are things called quarks. I didn't like that line. In a way, that's a little too much like chemistry to me, kind of complicated. There's another line coming down from the electron, just going all the way down. As far as we know, through numerous experiments, there's nothing inside the electron. Now, that may seem like a strange subject to have started on, because it seems if there's nothing inside of it, what can you do with it? Okay. Now, nature has been very kind. The electron was found about 100 years ago after a great deal of work in Europe, particularly in Britain, and the man most noted for it, J.J. Thomson, finally elucidated the nature of the electron. And the electron is the basis, as I've shown you, of all the chemistry, and it's also the basis of all the electronics we know, electric power and everything. It's very important. About 60 years ago, another particle was found called the muon in a very different way. Coming into our atmosphere from outside the Earth, and mostly outside the solar system, are particles of very high energy, mostly protons. Not all, they can be heavier too, but mostly protons. when these protons come through and hit the atmosphere, say this is a proton coming in from outer space, and let me just put a few of these things together. And this is just, say, an air molecule over here. When the proton comes in and hits it, at high enough energy, another particle comes out, which itself is not stable, and I won't go into it. It's called a pion, and that in turn decays into something called a muon. And that was found in the 1930s and 40s. Now, the muon, as I've written up here, is much heavier than the electron, about 200 times heavier. It also seems to have no size or extremely small size. And we can't do very much with it because it's not stable. So after I got into physics and did some other work, and mostly working on protons and things, I got interested in this problem. It's just like an Erector set problem. There's only two things you have here, an electron and a muon, and how are they related? Why is one 200 times heavier than the other? And I decided to work on this problem. It's not original. Lots of other people have thought about it. But I jumped into it too, because it fit what I liked. In doing that, I followed one of my precepts, which I'd learned earlier in graduate school, actually working with Robbie, which may seem somewhat surprising. This is sort of advice to young scientists. You don't have to know everything. This is very important to know these days when knowledge is expanding so fast. I actually think that most of our students are overeducated. You just have to sort of know enough. What's wrong with knowing too much? First of all, it overloads your brain. And you know all the difficulties of doing anything. It sort of paralyzes you into just doing what other people are exactly doing. So you always can learn in experimental work by either reading a book or reading a paper or taking a course or copying somebody else's work. Nothing wrong with copying. You can learn something when you need it, and that's very important in both research and engineering these days. Okay, so one of my precepts is jump in some sense, and I jumped into this field. And I followed another precept, which I had learned in graduate school. Okay. What's wrong with smart people who talk a lot? That's fine if they're not your colleagues. Why? Because to work in science or engineering or many other fields, you want to get new ideas. But most new ideas are bad ideas. But some bad ideas can be changed into good ideas, but you need time. If you start out with a bad idea and some very smart colleagues say, oh, this will not work, it's been tried by so-and-so, and also there's this problem with this theorem that doesn't allow it, well, you get discouraged. But if they leave you alone, then you may eventually stumble into something which is better. So I, being sort of obstinate, jumped into the problem of trying to understand the electron and the muon, these two particles. And I avoided all colleagues who I knew were smarter than me and talked too much. On the other hand, I looked as much as I could for colleagues who were smarter than me and didn't say much, because they are the best kind. They will pull you out of difficulties, they'll give you new ideas, and so forth. And I jumped into the problem of trying to understand the relation between the electron and the muon. And now I have to tell you something about how we work in our field. Now, the big difficulty in our field is that everything we deal with is too small to open up, to cut open and look inside as you would do it in chemistry, in biology, and even in atomic physics. You cannot get inside it. We have no way to do it. Now, it could be that 100 years from now, we will have wonderful ways to do it. But right now, we don't know how to do it. And so we're stuck with these things. And how then do we know what's going on? How do we know? Well, we actually only have two ways. One way is some of these particles, like the muon, are unstable. And let's say, I can't really do this, but let's say that this is a muon, and it sits around, but in about a millionth of a second, they tend to break up, more or less. So it's sitting there. Suddenly it disappears, and out come three particles, strangely enough, an electron and two other particles called neutrinos, which are particles which have, again, no size, probably no mass, or small mass, and no charge. So this muon suddenly breaks up into three particles which go flying out in all directions. It can do that because it has a lot more mass than these other three particles. So one thing we do is study the decay. So you have a muon just before the decay, it just sits there, and then it breaks up right after the decay, but there's extra energy, and then it just flies open, just flies apart. So that's one way we investigate these particles. The other way, and the only other way we really have, has to do with we collide them together. And that's what the accelerator at Triumph does and many other machines around the world. So, for example, green is now electron. You take two electrons, and you can actually collide them together. I'll say a little bit more how you actually sort of get them to hit. Now, often they'll just collide together, and like two baseballs, they'll come apart again. So they collide, and they come apart. And that's not very surprising. We understand that. But sometimes something else happens. They collide. If you have a negative and a positive electron, positive one's called a positron, they can disappear, make energy, and out can come a positive and a negative particle, such as muons. So you can change electrons into muons. And that's a very beautiful, very simple reaction. You have to get these with enough energy to make the muons. And how much energy do you need? Well, that's back to Einstein. That's what E equal mc squared means. The energy you need is proportional to the mass you have to make multiplied by a constant, which happens to be the velocity of light squared. So if you put enough energy into these, sometimes they will disappear and out will come muons. Well, that collision, that sort of work, I worked on trying to understand the difference between the electron and the muon. And I worked on it at Stanford for about 5 or 6 years, and the experiments were great. We had some beautiful pieces of apparatus. They were very dramatic. They worked beautifully. And we measured things about the electron, things about the muon, and then we were looking at other people's data. And after about 5 or 6 years, it dawned on me that maybe I should have spoken to some smarter people. We were getting nowhere. The measurements were difficult to make, they were hard to compare, and I wasn't learning anything about the electron or the muon. So, I went back to one of my precepts. Well, here was another bad idea. And I'd had some other ones. Maybe I could now try another idea, which maybe would be a good one. But to do that, I also had to do something which I've done a lot, which is pay attention to what I call the art of obsession in experimental science. And this is also true in engineering, if you're trying to build a new device, true in many things, medicine. If you're trying to get something going, you have to be obsessed with it. You should be thinking about it all the time. When you wake up at night, it should not be that you're worrying about your children. You should be worrying about the experiment. You should be worrying, is it running? Is the student that you left in charge really there? You should be worrying whether the director of your laboratory has gone to Ottawa or to Washington to get more money so you can run it. That's the obsession with the experiment, and it's crucial. On the other hand, at some point, that's happened after 5 or 6 years, in this case, you have to say, this is not getting anywhere. You have to give up the obsession. And you do that, if you can, by the following. You say to yourself, this is either a good idea or a bad idea. If it's a bad idea, let's give it up. If it's a good idea, but I don't know how to do it, the young people who are coming along, they are better trained than we are. They will have more knowledge, more equipment than we do because they will know more. They'll be more flexible than we are because they're fresh in the field. If it's a good idea in 10 or 20 or 30 or 100 years, they will get back to it. And if it's a good idea, it will be done and something will be found. There's a crucial difference between creativity in science and creativity in art, it seems to me. There's only one Picasso, one Shakespeare, one Beethoven. Other people may look like Picasso or sound like, but there's only one. If they're not there, that work is not done. In science, creativity is not the same. It will eventually be done. If Einstein had not done this very remarkable set of things consisting of understanding many, many effects from the photoelectric effect, special relativity, general relativity, it would have been done eventually. Maybe 5 years later, maybe 10 or 20 years later, the terms would be different, the formulas, he would not have used E equal MC squared, he may have used, T for energy and something else for mass, but the same equation would exist. So in a sense, one can be or should be a lot more humble in science than in art because somebody else will eventually do it. Anyway, I then decided, since I wasn't learning anything about the electron or the muon, I said, two is a funny thing in nature. When one thing is 200 times heavier than the other, because the muon is 200 times heavier than the electron, it doesn't make sense. I said, I know what it is now. There's a series of heavier and heavier particles, the electron, the muon, something heavier, something still heavier, something still heavier. And that's the way to look. We'll find these heavier ones, study those, and then, from doing that, we'll come back and understand all about the electron and the muon. So that was the idea. We'll carry out the same collision. Put in enough energy so that not muons come out, but something different. I don't know, let these cups be the unknown difference. These things would come out. Okay, now to do that, It's not simple. You can't just do this with your hands the way I'm doing it. You need a lot of equipment, okay? And just a few words to tell you about the kind of size of equipment that we have to use in this particular field. Now, when I did this particular work in the 1970s, you didn't need as big equipment as you do now to go on, but this is my laboratory, Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. You'll see in this corner a small machine called Spear. That's where we did our work. There are now much bigger machines, as you can see by the rings, but everything has to be very big. There's no way really around that. One of the largest machines in the world right now. It's Switzerland, and some people here work there. And there's a machine. You can see there's a lake, and this round circle indicates a machine, and that diameter is about 9 or 10 kilometers. It's an enormous machine, and the kinds of experiments that are set out on it are also very big. This is just an example of a picture of one experiment, a big piece of apparatus, and you see the people in the lower right-hand corner. It's very big. Our equipment was not that big, but still quite big. So, we began to, with some colleagues, we began to collide electrons and positrons together at the highest energy then available. People have now gone to much higher energies. And in about 1975, I began to find evidence that when you collided electron and positron together at enough energy, sometimes you got out other particles which were not electrons, were not muons, and were much heavier. And these particles I eventually called the tau. Now, there were two. The experiments at the beginning were, I wouldn't say difficult. They were very, very high anxiety. One thing that you're again never told about in science, particularly in experimental work, is the anxiety and emotion involved. It's all told very calmly. You've put a lot of work into this. A lot of other people have put money into it, time into it. The apparatus may not be working. You may get it working, and you may see interesting results, but they may be fake. Something may be wrong with the apparatus. The apparatus may be giving results which you're interpreting wrong, because you want so much for something to be true. An example of that we were just talking about the other night was this cold fusion question, which came up about 4 years ago. The people who wanted to believe in cold fusion wanted it so much to be true that they sort of distorted the results of the experiments, and there's still people, some people still believe it. How then in experimental science do you get verification that the result is right? There's two ways which have to go in sequence. Number one, other people working in your field have to get the same result. They must get the same result. That's the first way. The second way is an experiment that's difficult now, hard to interpret, must get simpler and simpler. That's how you tell atomic physics or elementary particle physics or microbiology from telepathy. In telepathy, it's as hard to do as it was 500 years ago or in the 1930s when Rhind did it. It's always hard to do somehow. you haven't quite got this subject working right, it's a bad day for them, and so forth. In science, it must get easier and easier, surer and surer, and eventually, if the thing is at all useful, it must go into the technology. Okay, so in the middle 70s, I began to find evidence for the existence of the Tao, and it's extremely heavy. It's about 3,400 times heavier than the electron. Ah, I had found the next member of the sequence, and as Mr. Lemon mentioned, that led to the so-called third generation of particles. The electron led to the first, the muon to the second, and this was to the third. Now, somehow, though I only had 24 records of what seemed like evidence, and then a little bit later, a year later, I had 106, we were not believed. The only other laboratory at that time which could do the same kind of experiment was in Hamburg in Germany, a very good laboratory. But there's another thing you have to be prepared for in science. If you get a result first, and it's a little bit unsure, other people don't gain very much by agreeing with you. They'll gain much more by showing if you're wrong, by showing you're wrong. So for about 3 years, we kept finding evidence for the Tao at Stanford and with our collaborators. And out of the laboratory in Hamburg, they kept finding nothing. They wouldn't say anything. They didn't look right to them. The first evidence I got that somebody else was seeing these things, after all, if they're going to be in California, they have to be in Hamburg. I was visiting Japan, the University of Tokyo. The Japanese were just getting into this field, and they had a small group working in Hamburg sort of as apprentices, learning the art. And they said to me, oh, you know, our colleagues have sent back information that they are sort of seeing this Tao also. And I got very excited. I said, oh, I've got to see. What have they sent you back in the letter? And they took out the letters, and of course, they were completely in Japanese. And so I sat there sort of believing that they were translating it correctly. Well, after about 3-4 years, it turned out that, of course, we were right in this case, and other laboratories began to find the same results. So that's the first point. The second thing which has happened in the Tao, I said we had first 24 events, then 106 events. At a laboratory I work at quite a lot now, which is at Cornell, we have 5 million events stored of the Tao, 5 million Taos. In fact, it's become sort of an uninteresting workhorse now of the PhD high energy physics industry. If you have a student working on something difficult, say, and you're associated with our experiment at Cornell, and it's not going well and they want to get out, you say, oh, go work on the Tao. We have a big sample, and you can always write one more thing about it because it breaks up, it decays in a lot of different ways. So it's become sort of a workhorse, but it has no application. Why? Well, because I told you that the muon breaks up in about a millionth of a second. This thing breaks up in a millionth of a second. So it exists, and it has taught us a lot about how the universe works, but it's not something that we can use in technology. Well, if you recall, I got into all this because I was convinced there was an electron, a muon, something heavier, which we call the Tau, then there'd be something heavier, heavier, and heavier, and that's the way the world was made. And that was my original idea in the 1970 when I began all this. But nature is full of surprises. We worked at a certain energy, which in units, which are called GeV. We worked at 4 GeV, and that's how we found the Tau. The big machine I showed you in Switzerland has now been up to about 180 GeV. So 180 over 4 is 45. They've been up to 45 times more energy than we ever had. That is, they're colliding electrons and positrons with 45 times the energy than we ever used. The next thing in this series has not appeared. And we sort of know from other evidence that it's rather difficult to find something very analogous to the Tau. There probably are lots of other things. So the next surprise of nature was then that that the three generations or the electron is somehow special and two isn't. Why that is, I have again no idea. And I don't know what to do about trying to think about it. I don't have any good ideas about it. And people at places like CERN at Switzerland have gone up these very high energies. There's no sense we doing the same thing. We don't have. And so we've ended up then in this story with the electron muon and the tau. And exactly in this series, there probably are no more, but there may be very heavier things like that in this series. Now, the lessons from this sort of work are, as I've said, to try always to think in new directions, to try new ideas, and to be prepared also to abandon those ideas if they don't pay off. I'm always very optimistic about the future, because in research, because one thing which again is not emphasized nearly as much as it should be is this: experiment and technology are completely intertwined. They always were. But in the modern world, where so much technology is done now in other places in industry, we're so intertwined. And you can never tell what's going to be ahead in technology. And I'll conclude with two examples from my days as a chemical engineer in a General Electric company. I worked as a chemical engineer in the electron tube division. And we were not a research group. We were attached more to factory, trying to improve things. We worked on two problems. One, and the older people in the audience remember, we worked on vacuum tubes. Those are these little tubes that used to be in radios. And you remember when you turned on the radio, it took time to warm up because there's a filament in those vacuum tubes that has to get red hot. And you could always see if your radio was working by looking in the back and you see these little red things around. Now, one of the things that my chief wanted to do, General Electric was already making portable radios, but they didn't last, the batteries ran out very quickly. And so he had the idea, and this was about 1950 when I joined him, of making extremely small vacuum tubes so that he had a very little filament, didn't need very much heat, and the battery would last a long time. Also, the marketing people said, if we could put out a radio, which as soon as you turned it on, the news came on, it'd be wonderful to use the arguments against the other radio people at the time, RCA, Philco, Sylvania, all those other radio people. And we were working on making smaller and smaller vacuum tubes. And seeing if the machines could be made smaller and costs and all that. And this was General Electric in Schenectady, New York, one of the great, powerful industrial research companies. At the same time, in New Jersey, at Bell Labs, the transistor was invented. And it's the transistor that solved not only a portable radio problem, but all other problems. In other words, we had exactly the wrong technology, not just us, but all of General Electric Company. So you can never tell what's coming ahead in technology. Now, strangely enough, the other thing I worked on were television picture tubes. They're these things which are about this big, and they're always the biggest part of the television set. And now in computers, they're the biggest part of the monitor. And we wanted to, and they're made on a production line, and we were working on speeding it up, and I have some patents in that field, one thing and another. Strangely enough, and that was in the 50s, to this day, although it may finally be changing, the cheapest way to still make a picture in a television set or a computer is to use one of these picture tubes. So there's a technology which 45 years later has not really changed. Of course, they're color and they're much brighter and they're sharper, but the basic idea has never changed. Because experiment and technology are so interwoven now, and so much of our technology comes not out of the basic research lab, but out of industry, I'm always optimistic about what will happen in the future in our field as well as other fields. Now we indeed build big machines and big detectors. In 100 years from now, they may be on the tabletop, or they may not. It all depends on what the human mind can develop within the laws of nature. And as I said before, we don't know how that will go, and we do know that there will be very many bad ideas to a few good ideas, but there's no clear limit to that. And so I'm always an optimist about basic research, but I can never give you a time scale as to when things will change. Thank you. Let's see. I'm supposed to repeat the question. You said, is it not ironic that the World Wide Web came from the lab in Switzerland, CERN and Stanford? And then you said, and what was the second question point?
Are nuclear physicists related?
A nuclear physicist. I don't quite understand that. I think what the coming of the World Wide Web indicates is exactly my point about technology. There were certainly an awful lot of people working in all the Silicon Valleys of the world trying to think of new things. And the fact that it came out of a group of people who were just trying to exchange information in a rather small group, but over large distances, indicates to me, again, the amazing way that good ideas arise. The tau, unfortunately, I'll repeat the question. I'm sorry, thanks, Dave. What are the implications of the muon discovering the tau discovery for medical research? The tau, because of its very short lifetime, we see no way to use in any application at this time. The muon is used quite a bit to investigate the properties of solids. I don't know if anything has ever been done to look at the possibility of muon beams, somebody else, for example, things like cancer therapy. I don't know that. But the muons are used quite a bit in applied research. The group, how many people were in my group when we discovered the tau? It was about 30 people, which is, of course, smaller than the groups have to be now, because the machines are so much bigger and the costs are so much more work to do. But now we're doing something new, which is looking for fractionally charged particles, and in fact there's just five of us. In some fields, if you want to work in small groups, then you have to get a little bit out of the mainstream. There's a plus and a minus of being out of the mainstream. You have less competition and you get more credit for what you do. On the other hand, most things which are out of the mainstream are bad ideas, because if they were good ideas, a lot of people would be working on them. So there's always that chance. There's another thing. If you work in a small group, as we are now on our fractional charge search, when you get stuck, you really get stuck. You don't know how to answer it. The other four people don't either. And that's the end. You don't know what to do. Well, you jump in and keep changing things till you stumble. So there's some big advantages and a lot of intellectual power in the larger groups where there are very many smart people. The question is, when you look for a hypothetical particle, do you know how much mass it'll have, how much energy you need, or do you keep ramping it up? In most cases, if you're being very speculative as we were, you don't know. And so you just have to be fortunate that at Stanford we had enough energy. In other cases, particles will be predicted in a theory which is already well based. In that case, you simply go to a certain region and look for the particle. If it's not there, that's the end of that theory. We don't like theories that can keep changing the mass, so no matter how high in energy you go, they go above you, but there's not much we can do about it. You could always ask the very big question, is we keep going up in energy because that's all we old-timers in some way know how to do, and we sort of... There will be young people, I am sure, who will come with other ideas of how to look for these things. If I knew what, I would do it myself. Right now, yeah, you do. If you have no idea, you keep going up in energy till the machine's at its maximum. Well, there are no more than the electron, the muon, and the tau have associated with them a different kind of neutrino. And those neutrinos are very light particles and easy to make. What's been found, primarily by the work done at CERN, is that there are only three kinds of neutrinos of that kind. If there's yet a heavier particle like the tau, it also would have a very heavy neutrino. So it doesn't quite follow the model. But then nature may have decided to shift after three. I mean, it may be an enormously rich thing up there, and the first three are simple with low mass neutrinos, and then it gets heavier. So within the confines of what the experiment is, it's certainly correct. There haven't been any enabling inventions in what field since the laser?
In any field.
Yeah, the question is, do I have a comment on the fact that there haven't been any major inventions since the laser? I think that, again, it's impossible to know the rate at which technology will advance. The next set of inventions may come more in the biological field, for example. That may really be the next direction. I'm just always optimistic about how they will come. I don't see any end to inventions.
Thank you.
can the discovery of new particles help us understand what happened at the beginning of the universe and the Big Bang? It can either help or hinder. There is, as you know, one of the ideas is that there's a large number of particles which are called dark matter, which are in the universe, don't give off light, but constitute a lot of the mass of the universe. If such a particles can be found, and there are some terrestrial experiments looking for them, that would be extremely important. On the other hand, if we found these fractionally charged particles that we are looking for, they could disturb a lot any of the specific ideas about how the Big Bang actually occurred. I tend to be always a little skeptical about how much we know about the universe. I agree it started small and now it's getting big, but I tend to be rather slow about accepting as dogma many of the things that are said about it. The reason is this. Another characteristic of all scientists is a tremendous desire to know and understand and explain. Now, the field of astronomy observation and astrophysical observation is enormous now. It's expanding tremendously. It's the most amazing thing. The new large ground-based telescopes, the Hubble telescope, the sort of thing, the SNOW experiment being built in Canada, which is going to look at neutrinos coming again from the sun and other places. All these things are teaching us much more. We're in a very early stage, but astrophysicists and astronomers get impatient, and they try to fit everything in. And so one has to just be very patient. It's maybe a little bit like the early days of medicine, in which the germ theory, you now know the germ theory, but you don't know a lot about most diseases, and maybe you hardly understand viruses at all. I would say that's probably the state, but the data that's coming in is amazing. Tau. Well, yes, the question is, the muon is actually found in nature. Can the tau be found in nature? You could find it by looking at very high cosmic rays coming into the atmosphere. It'd be a difficult experiment. And once in a while, it would certainly make the tau, but not very often. It'd be hard to find. The aspect of the tau, which is actually in nature and very confusing, is its neutrino. There's this whole, as I said, with every of these particles, there come these neutrinos. The tau neutrino may be being produced all the time if neutrinos can change into different kinds of neutrinos. So strangely enough, it's actually the tau neutrino, which is more involved in nature, but not so easy to detect. But people have, there are a number of experiments trying to look for it.
Yes, one final question.
What has been the relation in your career between teaching and research?
Okay, what is the relation in my career between teaching and research? I've done a lot of teaching. I taught at the University of Michigan. I taught someone at Stanford. I wrote a textbook. Frankly, teaching, in my view, is an extremely hard job. A good teacher has to work to the best and to the best students and the worst students in the class, has to try to keep them all interested, all learning, and so forth. I always resented having to give up research to prepare the lecture because I don't think fast enough. So I would have to be completely prepared on a lecture for all the ordinary questions, and then whatever all the smart students might also ask. And it took a lot of work. In later years, I reduced my work to only working with graduate students on their theses. because then with them I can be very honest. And when we meet, when I get together, they say, what's happening? And I say, I don't know what's happening, and I'll go off and work on it, and you go off and work on it. So I have, my personality fits best that kind of teaching. And there is nothing better than you come to this point where you're working with a graduate student, maybe after a year or two, and they say, well, you're wrong. You've got this wrong, you've calculated it wrong, you made a mistake, or here's a better way to do it. And you first have to catch yourself, because you think, well, they don't know anything. And then you say, my God, they're right. And that is the most wonderful. I had this experience, this is my, in this other thing we're doing is fractional charge search. There's a young woman from France and Israel who was originally a theoretical student who went into experimental work. And she's working on an experiment, and we were dealing with high voltage, and she wanted to make it higher, and I had some ideas. I said, let's put a lot of FETs, that's a certain kind of integrated circuit, together, and that's how you'll get this high voltage, and so forth and so forth. And then she came back next day, and she said, you know, if we have to put these together, that's really a bad idea. We'll have to put together 50 of them. We'll never get the thing to work properly. We've got to find another way to do it. And I said to her, you really become an experiment. And that's, thank you.
Okay, now I'd like to ask Dr. Alan Astbury, the director of Triumph, to thank our speaker.
Thank you.
It's a very great personal pleasure to thank Professor Pearl on your behalf for this very exciting lecture. But let me get the terminology straight first of all. Professor Pearl is known as Marty Pearl, I think, and Marty Pearl to almost every high-energy physicist in the world over the age of about 25 knows him as Marty Pearl, so I think we will call him Marty this evening. You have seen from his lecture that he's the experimentalist's experimenter. This was not your average physics lecture that was probably very well organized and fairly boring. But if you listen carefully, what you heard this evening, I think, from Marty, was that if you can think clearly and you have a lot of common sense, there really isn't any reason why you can't do research in physics, really. I think that was, well, at least that's, I think, what I heard, and that's what I see in a lot of good experimenters. Now, I think in the discovery of the tau lepton, well, understandably, I think he sold himself a little bit short. I don't know what was going on in his mind. It's obviously a very unusual mind, but a subject goes forward by discoverers, as he told you. It's experimentally driven. There are theorists. They provide a framework, but it's really the experiment that drives it. And what he had in this detector in Stanford was, let's call it a signature. It was a pattern of particles, which was very strange. Very hard to understand. Perhaps he understood it at the time, but certainly most of the rest of the people did not understand it. And I would say they even recoiled from it. It was so unusual. And of course, detectors also don't work perfectly. I mean, they have their limitations. And also, to make matters worse, these particles, they do certain things on the average. Now, it's like your family, or like your friends, or like your kids. You know, on the average, they're pretty good, but occasionally they really surprise you. And these particles can do that. And so it's very difficult to say that you very definitely have this and not something else. But Marty stuck with this signature, and it took a lot of courage, because there was a broad spectrum, some disbelief. People said, well, it's Marty, there has to be something in it. Mostly, and I think he would believe that this was correct, honest skepticism. But over a period of about 3 years, as he said, he proved he had enough courage to show that he was right, and he had enough courage to establish the tau lepton. Now, as he pointed out, that was a leading discovery. We learnt it from the muon. It already told us there had to be two more kinds of quark and another kind of neutrino. And indeed, quite soon after the tau lepton, after his work, the B quark, it's gone under many names, bottom quark, beauty quark, but I think B is perhaps the one that's most widely used, was found in the late 70s. But then it needed a partner. It needed the infamous top quark. Now, leading in such a way, it took 20 years. It was 94, 95 before the top quark was discovered. So prompted by Marty, and I think if all the governments in the world sent him the bill for all of the unsuccessful top searches, personal bankruptcy would be the only option, I think, actually. It was an enormous amount of money spent, eventually found, and as he made the point, and I think it's perhaps true, we haven't yet directly observed the tau lepton, the tau neutrino. And indeed, in a few years, it may hold some secrets for mass in the neutrino system. So as you can see, this man, this unusual man with his discovery, opened up a large branch of the subject and produced a whole new, as we call it, generation or family of particles. The one thing that you must have learned or must have observed from this talk is that you have a person who is different. And I think it's true to say that in his research, he has always, and I think deliberately, followed the road less traveled. I mean, there's the famous poem that ends with the two lines, "I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference." And they fit him perfectly, those two lines. They could have been written for him. So, Marty, on behalf of all of us, and from me, thank you for a wonderful lecture and a memorable evening. Thank you.
Thank you. Very kind. Very kind. Yeah. Thank you.